I'm Steve Lascalzo, and this is The Way. Thank you for joining me to discuss what might be the best Star Wars show on Disney Plus. I know, I might be getting ahead of myself. We're only 4 episodes in, but the show is so good. And I haven't been this excited since season 1 of The Mandalorian. You're listening to This Is The Way podcast and the season 1 episode 4 reaction and discussion of Andor. Aldani is a name that sounds familiar, even if it isn't. And boy, do the Scottish, Aldani Highlands look amazing on screen. A reminder before I get started here. Everything in the show, it's taking place before the movie Rogue One. This podcast is happening way after that, though. So we know what happens to the hero of the show. But sometimes, you know, the journey's more important than the destination. Episode 4 is titled Aldani, but I'm not sure if Coruscant might have been just as appropriate, given how much time we spend there. Now, if you continue listening, you're going to hear what some people consider spoilers. But if you haven't seen the show, you shouldn't be listening to a podcast about it, right? So, if you're listening without having seen the episode, just know what you're getting into. Hey, I do listen to podcasts like House of the Dragon podcast without having seen episodes because I don't have HBO. But I know that I'm hearing about the show. That's what I'm going there for. You will hear about this week's episode of Andor, and I will reference other Star Wars shows and movies that have already been released. Are you ready for the discussion? Well then,
let's go!
The writer for episodes 4 through 6 will be Dan Gilroy, showrunner Tony Topic Gilroy's brother. He comes from good writing stock, but honestly, if you want to know what I think is most impressive, it's probably that he's married to Rene Russo. I think it's smart that Gilroy is paired up for the next 3 episodes with the same director, Susanna White. I didn't notice anything in her resume that stood out, but she's been working a while, and like Haynes, she didn't get it in the way of a good script in episode 4. The runtime for episode 3 shows up as 50 minutes in parentheses on the Disney Plus show page. It's the longest episode of the 4 that have been released, and I honestly wanted more. The action runs more than 41 minutes and 38 seconds from the start of the Andor title screen at the open until cutting to black off Cashin at the Aldani campfire. I still haven't noticed a visual difference in the opening title sequence, but there was another variation on the show's theme. Composer Nicholas Britell came up with 12 different versions, and number 4 fits the variations on a theme well. He's showing up in the first few search results on Spotify, too. He's still not the top result for Star Wars Andor, which is mind-blowing to me, but he's doing good work, and if he keeps churning it out, maybe he will be recognized on the same kind of level as some of the other greats, like, well, Ludwig Göransson, maybe Kevin Kiner, Michael Giacchino. And no, I'm not going to put anybody on the same level as John Williams. I mean, you'd have to put out a long, long series of absolute smash hits for me to even mention you in the same breath, but I guess I did already, huh? The thumbnail description available on the show's Disney Plus episodes tab reads, out of options, Cashin is recruited for a dangerous mission to infiltrate an Imperial garrison. The description on the show's episode page in Disney Plus is more descriptive. It reads, out of options, Cashin joins a mission to infiltrate an Imperial garrison on Aldani. Meanwhile, on the city-covered capital world of Coruscant, agents of the Imperial Security Bureau start to piece together information regarding the disturbance on Ferrix, while Senator Mon Mothma carefully maneuvers webs of intrigue. Okay, time to talk actors, and boy, do we get some good ones introduced in this episode.
You think anybody's listening?
We'll start with the star of the show and mention again that Diego Luna is Cashin Andor, although the character does take his adoptive father's name Clem has an alias in this episode. Luthen Rael is Stellan Skarsgård, and he just does amazing work. He's both his gruff rebel self and then this persona cover version of himself as a shopkeeper on Coruscant. Great. Imperial Security Officer Dedra Miro is played by Denise Gao. She isn't even listed on the IMDb for the episode, but I vaguely remember reporting on her casting. She's voiced a number of video games, including the voice of Yennefer in The Witcher 3, some Dragon Quest games, and she was a voice in Star Wars Battlefront 2. She was most recently in Under the Banner of Heaven, and she was one of the many Laffertys on that show. I didn't really watch that show, but I remember seeing something about it. Andrew Garfield played a lead role. Major Partagaz is played by Anton Lesser, and he's probably best known as Maester Qyburn on Game of Thrones, but he's got a career dating back to the 70s, and he just knocks it out of the park in this episode. I'm very excited to see what's coming from his character. He just fits the Star Wars universe so well. Lieutenant Supervisor Blevin is played by Ben Bailey-Smith, and though he has a nice BBC resume, I have the feeling this role is going to get him a lot more work. He is fantastic. Supervisor Lonnie Young, the guy who name-drops Scarif in the ISB meeting, is played by Robert Emms. And I feel like his work on Chernobyl is what got him this part. There are a lot of actors from that show getting parts in Andor. Supervisor Legret is Michael Jenn. Supervisor Grandy is Lucy Russell, another Chernobyl alumni. And a lot of these roles may have been added later in the production. They're not large in the grand scheme, but boy, the flavor that these actors are bringing to this Star Wars world building is just phenomenal. Vel Sartha of Aldani is Faye Marseille, and I kept saying, I know her. Where do I know her from? She's the waif from Braavos on Game of Thrones. So she played the waif in that show. Cyril Karn is back, dejected, returning home to mommy. Kyle Soller, well, not the mommy. Cyril Karn is played by Kyle Soller, and this probably won't be the last that we see of his character. Chief Hine and Sergeant Linus Mosk had very little to do in this episode, but they both did so much good with the little that they appeared. Rupert Van Sittart as the chief and Alex Ferns as the hand-raising sergeant. Attendant Hirt, Miro's assistant, Jacob James Beswick. Karis Nemec is played by Alex Lothar, and he does a great job of creating an immediately likable rebel who may be just a bit in over his head. And it pairs so well with that much more jaded Arvel Skeen, played excellently by Eben Moss Bachrach. Fellow rebel Terriman Barcona is Gershwin Eustace Jr. Cinta Kaz is the rebel medic, played by Virata Sethu. Edie Karn is Catherine Hunter, and that was, she played Arabella Fig. Edie Karn is Cyril's mom. She was in Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, and her neighbor that she says, what are you looking at, is credited as Apple Brook. And the only reason I'm mentioning her in that here 1 minute gone the next part is she played Professor Grubbly Plank in the same movie, Order of the Phoenix. Longtime BBC actor Lee Ross plays the guy with the senator in the shop. He's like the new driver, almost definitely an Imperial spy, right? He is shown 14,000-year-old coins by Clea Markey, played by Elizabeth Dulau, and for such a small role, she does a great job. I want to see more of her. Lieutenant Gorn is Sule Rimi. One of the things I appreciate about the casting of these rebels on Aldani, none of them overplayed their role. They played very careful without being overly cynical. You know, they're risking their lives for a cause, and we need to like them, sympathize with them, form quick relationships with them so we feel losses deeper and betrayals will cut more, right? Now, I have no idea who's going to make it out of the operation alive. Maybe it's all of them, but I like this group of merry men. Perrin Firtha is Alistair McKenzie, and what a terrific job he does playing the husband of a powerful senator, a war veteran. He seems to typify the arrogance of extravagance in the Empire's social circles. He's a potential familial foil to his wife, played by Genevieve O'Reilly, reprising her role from the prequels, even if those were some cutscenes, and then Rogue One as Mon Mothma. She is phenomenal. I cannot say enough about how well she plays this part. It gives me a lot of insight into the character that we only get to see briefly in the original trilogy, played by Carolyn Blackiston.
Nobody here gives their real name.
Let's get on with the show. There's the Disney Plus splash screen, a previously on segment, the Lucasfilm Star Wars sequence, and then the title sequence. Another new theme variation from composer Nicholas Britell leads into the action. It's Cashin and Luthen making the getaway on his ship. It's a Fondor Hallcraft, apparently. And Andor is surprised that it can make the jump to light speed, I think. He's grateful it can, of course, but I love these small details. It world builds so efficiently without, you know, a long monologue or lots of different shots. It just does the job so quick. Andor's arm is hurt. He's fumbling for a medkit. Luthen Rail drops a line that we just heard in Obi-Wan Kenobi.
"You're bleeding on my floor."
So I just wonder, what did these writers see in the last year or so, the ones from Obi-Wan Kenobi and Dan Gilroy, that make them think that this is a fun line to crib? It's just so weird. And then another world-building throwaway line.
"What's that?" "Mad Nog. Just a sip."
I know, it's no blue milk, but if you think we're not making Mednog this holiday season, you're just crazy. The conversation that's taking place is extremely important.
"Define important."
"Taking something of real value from the Empire."
Okay, well, Cashin is for the second time in just a few minutes posed the question about whether or not he wants to continue a life of theft or if he wants to put his skills to better use for a bigger purpose. Cashin's very skeptical. He lumps Luthen in with all the kinds of people he's probably come into contact with over the years. Alliance, Separatist, Guerrilla, Partisan Front. To him, it's all the same. Luthen is a guy who did his homework, and he figures he laid out the right bait. And I wonder how many times he's had to do this before. How many guys has he gone through? Is Cashin special to him, or is he just another useful body? For his part, Cashin has a story about fighting on Mimban, which we saw in Solo. You know, in the mud for 2 years. We saw Han Solo doing that. Luthen, though, begs to differ about his resume.
"You were on the ground in Mimban for 6 months. You came in as a cook. You lived because you ran. But you're right about one thing. The Empire had you fighting each other. Which should make you hate them all the more, and you do. I said, I know you. I know the outside. I know what people tell me when I ask. The rest I imagine your hate. I imagine that no matter what you tell me or tell yourself, you'll ultimately die fighting these bastards. So what I'm asking is this. Wouldn't you rather give it all at once to something real? Then carve off useless pieces till there's nothing left."
Again, Luthen has done his research. It catches Cashin in a lie, but it also must, on some level, prove that this isn't just some guy trying to use him to make a buck. In the end, the real pitch is what we suspected.
"I didn't risk my ass for the Starbeth unit. I came for you."
Cashin takes the job. 5-day job, lots of danger, 200,000 credits if he survives and pulls it off. They're stealing the quarterly payroll for an entire Imperial sector. A sector controlled from Coruscant, which is where we go next. We are brought into this familiar world with an unfamiliar face. Dedra Miro, Imperial Security Bureau Supervisor, and her uniform gives off a distinct Nazi vibe, just in case we needed reminding that the Empire are the bad guys here. She's heading to a meeting of all the sector ISB supervisors, led here by Major Partagaz. Right off the top, we hear about Ryloth. If you watch Rebels and Clone Wars, you know about the efforts of Cham Syndulla and his daughter, Hera. It's a Twi'lek homeworld, And Supervisor Grandy says increased spending might be needed for increased surveillance after detention estimates might be low. This all kind of fits what we know from canon, or at least from what is canon according to Rebels and Clone Wars and things like that. So Party Guys is not pleased with her vague reasoning of anti-imperial sentiment, but we know that they are resisting. So Party Guys goes to Supervisor Legret next, who's in charge of Arvala 6. That's one planet closer to the system's suns than Arvala 7, which is home to Queel and the place where Grogu was being held captive in Episode 1 of The Mandalorian. They were on Arvala 7. Now, could that be where he is now? I mean, 14 years or so before we see him rescued by Din Djarin, he's a 50-year-old baby, right? I'm going to say no, though. This is just going to be one of those Easter eggs. We hear Arvala and we think, you know, about that. Supervisor Legret describes a problem with locals that has been handled, and mining has resumed on the planet. But Partagaz is more concerned that this staff seems to be reacting to things instead of controlling them. Legret is waiting on the planet's ministerial director to get in touch, but the Major wants go-getters, and we'll see later who he's talking about. This is when Partagaz chooses to reveal his personal ISB philosophy. They aren't spies, they're doctors.
What do we do in this building? Why are we here? Anyone?
We're here to further security objectives by collecting intelligence, providing useful analysis, and conducting effective covert action, sir.
Very good, Dedra. That is verbatim from the ISB mission statement and wrong. Security is an illusion. You want security? Call the Navy. Launch a regiment of troopers. We are healthcare providers. We treat sickness. We identify symptoms. We locate germs, whether they arise from within or have come from the outside. The longer we wait to identify a disorder, the harder it is to treat the disease. Do you understand my meaning, Legret?
Yes, sir.
Don't trouble yourself writing the memorandum. I'll reassign it.
The old dehumanizing tactic radicals are so fond of employing. Supervisor Blevin gets reassigned the Arvala 6 work, and again, we'll see why later, but he also details the problems going on in his sector, which happens to include Ferrix. Blevin mentions the Starpath unit, and that perks up Dedra Miro's ears. Apparently, this is something that maybe she was hiding or trying to hide, because her sector includes naval shipyards on Steerguard, the origin point of that NS9 Starpath unit that Cashin offered Luthen. So much to unpack from these scenes, but I couldn't help but think of a movie quote when Partagaz asked about their roles at the Imperial Security Bureau.
What do we do here?
What would you say you do here?
So Cashin shaves off the beard, and he turns himself into a new man. Not really, but kind of. I mean, he's deciding his undercover persona, and he chooses the name for the mission, Clem, based on his adoptive father. So the team that he's being brought in to supplement will know him as Clem. Luthen knows that this contact that's come to meet them won't be happy. So he goes outside to clear the air about him before Cashin, Clem, can meet this person. But before he goes, he loans Andor a down payment. It's Kyber Crystal, made into a signet for someone on Kuat, apparently. You know, the shipyards on Kuat. We will later see how he could come into possession of something like this, but this Kuati signet is clearly important to him. Most likely it's forbidden contraband based on its supposed value. Luthen says it's from the ancient world, and that it commemorates the uprising against Rakatan invaders. And from legends, that species, Rakata, was said to be the first species to develop hyperspace travel, and surely that made them a menace to previously isolated systems. So this symbolic uprising, it's more than just a trinket. This is almost like, hey, this celebrates this uprising, and that's what we're doing, right?
I want it back when this is over. If I live, I want it back.
Against 200,000.
Giving you my word.
Rail heads outside to talk with Vel Sartha and talks up Clem, as she'll know him, but she is very hesitant, despite all of his skills that he lists. One of those was language proficiency, and I looked up Alaran, Mio, and Nari, which is what was in the closed captioning. The only thing I found was a reference to the book Catalyst, which I forgot, which brought up Lyra Erso's friend, Nari. I just think Dan Gilroy just picked some names and the story group was like, yeah, sure. Vel is not pleased. Pouts visibly. I'm wondering if this is his daughter. You know, she's new to leadership. He's just patient enough to be caring, but impatient enough to yell at her when she's not paying full attention.
In the next 3 days, if for any reason... Look at me! You wanted to lead. This is what it comes to. You got 3 days. Something feels off, something turns. Someone starts to fold. You step up, you lead, you cancel the mission. I need to know you understand.
And if he's the problem?
Well, that's the advantage of renting him. He's disposable.
Both have blonde hair, blue eyes. I mean, yeah, there's more to, you know, genetics than just that. But I don't know. I kind of got that father-daughter vibe. The impression is that this is almost a make-or-break moment for the Rebellion. But if that's truly the case, there's not much hope to go around. Vel understands, though. She agrees. And it will be her idea to bring him in. At least that's how it's going to play to the group. Cashin's introduced as Clem. The two are going to head back to camp, which is a day's walk.
It took the combined ingredients of idiocy, ineptitude, and total disengagement for this farce to have reached the full apex of incredulous disaster.
Then we head to Morlana 1 and the security station there, where Blevin has taken over Chief Hines' office just as Hines said would come to pass. So Karn's screw-up doomed the planet to Imperial control, despite that order to bury the deaths of those corrupt guards. You know, the dead guards were corrupt under Hines' watch, just as Karn was insubordinate under his watch. So it's reasonable to agree with Blevin that he was ineffectual.
Seriously? My files are filled with corporate security fiascos, but this takes the prize.
And you, Deputy Inspector Karn.
Proud, are we?
So Mosk is one of my favorite characters just for some unknown reason. And I just love that raising the hand was just a laugh out loud moment for me. And once again, it shows how much better at humor this show has been than some of the other shows that are supposed to be comedies from Lucasfilm and Marvel. So anyway, the result of all of this, Karn's responsible for dooming the planet to military oversight. And that means there's going to be a plundering of this corporation by Imperial bureaucrats. And that may spell the end for several planets. I don't know how big this corporation is.
Take solace in this. You will not be replaced. You've rung the final bell on corporate independence. As of this morning, the Milana system is under permanent Imperial authority.
Cashin and Vel are on their way back to the rebel camp they've set up, and while he doesn't know much about Luthen, Vel's not going to tell him. But she does let him know now, high in the highlands, he's signed up for infiltrating a garrison. Now, this shouldn't be too much of a problem for him, right? He's familiar with conscription, even if he was just a cook, and he told Luthen the way to blend in was walk in like you belong. It doesn't sit well with him, though, but his angst is interrupted by the scream of a TIE fighter patrol coming over the ridge. Back on Coruscant, Miro is in her office trying to figure out what happened to that Starpath unit she heard mentioned. So it came from a base under her supervision, so she tells her assistant, go to Blevin, order the case be turned over to me. And then in the shot of him leaving her office, there's a bonsai tree. I wonder if this is a subtle nod or a parallel to Mon Mothma's residence. We'll see that later.
Orbiting Coruscant.
Your controls. Landing protocol 037.
Protocol 037.
The Luthen's trying to land. I know it probably would have been a step too far, but that had been landing protocol 66. I mean, it's probably better it wasn't. But, you know, that would have been a funny little nod there. But it's Landing Protocol 037 or something. So I talk a lot about the writing, though. Writing's not just dialogue. Dan Gilroy, writes a scene here. And ultimately, the director, Susanna White and Stellan Skarsgård, you know, make it come to life. But they didn't invent this thing whole cloth, I'm pretty sure. It's a scene of Luthen Rail taking off one personality of his true self, his rebel self. Then he puts on his Coruscanti cover. It's a businessman, a shop owner, collector, gallery owner. That allows him access to artifacts and to people who might, I don't know, bend the rules in order to get items which aren't always 100% legal, right? We already saw one of those items, that Kyber crystal, which technically might be outlawed. You know, the proximity of that to the culture of what is now the hated Jedi Order. But it's Skarsgård's subtle movements. And I saw an actor in a video citing how he comes up with certain characters, and dress is a huge part of that. So Rael, or Skarsgård, emoting to himself in the mirror, proves to me, at least, that it's harder for him to put on this self. I don't know. He's got to be smarmy, and he's got to be suave in this role, right? But it's real easy for him to just be the rebel, the guy who he earlier described to Cassian as one who might put a stick in the Empire's eye. It's just a great scene. Meanwhile, Andor and Vel take a break at an old abandoned settlement on Aldani, and he hears how the Empire came in, forced the natives into Enterprise zones. Another Nazi echo. You know, tell people where to live, destroy their culture, replace it with a new one. If Vel is Luthen's daughter, I wonder if they're both from Aldani or not, because she speaks passionately about it, and she knows a lot about the culture. But then again, if you're committed to this cause, maybe she just would be anyway, right? I did catch the line about those that are left in the hills were nature lovers, mystics, and dead enders. And I really wonder, does she kind of mean Jedi? You know, are we going to end up meeting a force-sensitive native? Or a Jedi in hiding? I think maybe the show could use it. Now, you know, despite the awesomeness without lightsabers and Jedi and Force, I think, you know, several of my friends have said, when are they going to meet a Jedi or something like that? I think just a little thing like that is all you need for a show like this. You don't need lightsaber battles to tie this in, but I would love to see someone help, you know, maybe even without the people knowing it, like a mind trick or a Force push at a crucial moment or something like that. It's one of those social media things, you know, tell me you're a Jedi without telling me you're a Jedi.
My assistant tells me you refused to turn over the file on this incident in Ferrix.
I have work to do.
That was an official request made by an officer of my staff.
I suggest you schedule an appointment.
The scene with Blevin and Miro is just another terrific example of efficiency in storytelling. It tells us all we need to know. Miro hasn't been in her position for a long time, doesn't appear to know how things really work, and paired with that reciting of the official ISB company line in the earlier meeting, that puts her a little on par with that guy Cyril Karn. She sees power. She thinks this is how people use it. But Blevin is just much more savvy, and that's going to win every single time. He even gives her advice she doesn't want to hear. It's an awesome scene from start to finish. His don't look down comment at the end is like an exclamation point.
Everyone's dead. While you were sleeping, they came in, slit everybody's throat. You ride with Mossy, Garbish, Saul Guerrera. Fall asleep on watch, they're gonna put your head on a pike for a laugh.
Sorry. Don't tell Val.
I won't. You will.
Even the actors with parts that are light on dialogue in this show prove how terrible an actor like Moses Ingram was in her main role in Obi-Wan. These guys, Nemec and Skeen, they haven't been in blockbuster movies or leads in mega-hit shows. They're just terrific in the scene. Yeah, I know, the writing helps, but Nemec is sleeping, and we're going to learn how pure of heart and how I think that shows he's not going to make it, but we also get him paired with Skeen. This jaded, a guy who's seen some stuff, you know, as evidence from his line about the other guys, the Mossy, Garvish, and Saw Gerrera, who the rebels, at least later on, don't really appreciate. I think that this guy Skeen is also doomed in this plot. I think Nemec and Skeen are not making it. Cassian and Vel have finally arrived after walking all night, but maybe their days are shorter? I don't know. Even with breaks, that's a lot of walking for those two. I'd have been tired. The rest of the rebels are at the camp. They're like skeptical, just like she was, of bringing in this new person. Vel represents it as him fighting himself free and having always been part of the plan, but her leadership is shaky. And I can just tell that's the case through her mannerisms and the way the others are reacting to her. Great acting by everybody there. And if I had to put my money on a traitor, based on that body motion and the scant dialogue, I think it's Cinta. I think she might be the traitor, if there is one. Something's just off about the medic to me. The score that takes us through the walk of Karn back to his home is really good. And we heard a few destinations of the spaceport. One of those was Hosnian Prime, which they're going to have to take off the boards in about 35 years or so after the First Order blows it away with Starkiller Base. No, that's not a spoiler if you haven't seen The Force Awakens. I'm sorry. We are briefly introduced to Karn's mother, Edie, played by Arabella Figg, actress Catherine Hunter. I think I mentioned it in the cast portion. She yells out to her nosy neighbor, supposedly played by Apple Brooks, who is the person credited playing Professor Grubbly or Grubbly Plank in the same movie, Order of the Phoenix.
What are you staring at?
Back on Aldani, Cashin is tended to by Cinta at the Rebel base, and he takes off the Quadi signet of Kyber Crystal and stuffs it in his pants. Maybe that's a sign. He also doesn't entirely trust her, or maybe he just doesn't trust anyone, but I think it might be her. She apologizes they don't have pain meds. I think that's a real-world thing that kind of crept into Star Wars, because I've never heard of pain meds being administered. And Bacta is supposed to be the gold standard of medication galaxy-wide by this point. It has been, though, for about 4,000 years. So it's not like it's hard to come by. But maybe this is just to hit home how bare-bones this operation is. The rest of the crew is not sure what to make of this late addition of Clem. Now in the hands of a lesser writer, I'd call it redundant, this scene. But the little personality traits we see flourish in Nemec and Skeen and Terriman and Vel, it makes the scene sing to me. They're nervous, and they should be. But ultimately, they believe in their cause, and their hope that Cashin or Clem is going to be trustworthy, that wins out the day.
Senator Mon Mothma's here. New driver.
Anyone we know?
Never seen him.
Oh man, this is one of the many scenes I just want to play. I just want to say, here, listen to this whole scene, because it is just amazing. Kleya is Luthen's shop assistant. We can already tell she is much more. She's as important as you'd expect that he would have at his side, not just in such an important place on Coruscant, but in such an important role. I'm just going to sing praises constantly about these scenes, by the way. I hope you don't mind me talking glowingly about it. Mon Mothma and Luthen dance with their dialogue in front of this new driver, who I'm guessing is 100% a spy, right? I think they all know it. Kleya maneuvers him to the side to look at coins. It's just masterful. But it's also necessary. Luthen gets her back to the back to talk real turkey. Real, real great dialogue the whole way back there. And then the scene kind of shifts and the camera work moves around. And then they get to the real discussion, right? Now, there's a lot of things to see in the gallery, by the way. I spent a lot of time looking frame by frame. I'm just telling you, there's just so much. And there's not labels on all this stuff, so I can't completely tell. But I think there's a Twi'lek Kalachori. We first saw Thrawn describe it in Rebels. And I think we saw one in another show, maybe in Obi-Wan. I don't know, but there's either a real Beskar chest plate there with pauldrons worth a mint, or just a nice model of one. There's a Gungan force shield that we saw in The Phantom Menace. It's back in the back wall. It's deactivated, of course. A Keldorian mask, kind of like Plo Koon would wear. And I'm not saying that it is his, but I think it's a nod to Dave Filoni from the props department. There's a bunch of stone carvings. They've got hands in the middle. It reminds me of the Clone Wars and Rebels, the gates of the worlds between worlds. The Mortis arc set up the father, the daughter, and the son. And then there was a carving on a big boulder or whatever, and the Empire had dug down to get to it. And then Ezra Bridger went and put his hands on it and moved things, and then it opened up a gate, you know, with the Loth wolves were running in a circle, and he went through and saved Ahsoka. I mean, it was a whole big thing. I think that's what that was, those little carvings. There was an Utapauan monk cudgel that was from Revenge of the Sith, where they were on Utapau. Obi-Wan Kenobi, it's a tie-in with the Grand Inquisitor, who was from Utapau. And that's where Obi-Wan was betrayed in Order 66 after killing Grievous. It's a feast for your eyes. But the dialogue is the real meal here. Luthen, he's clearly important. But we know also the Senator is facing real danger. So she's coming to him, and she's the money guy, or she's the money girl, I guess. And he's just like, hey, look, she's besieged, she says. There's new faces at the bank, new people surrounding her, new driver, and she's going to be the first one to fall. And if we didn't know what happens in the original trilogy, what would we be giving them as a percentage chance to survive all this, right? I mean, Luthen probably doesn't make it out. We don't see him, don't hear about him. But maybe he ends up taking the heat from the Senator. We know from the animated series, she's going to end up having to go in hiding before the events of Rogue One, because she speaks out against some atrocities. But, you know, she's the money here. Luthen's the boots on the ground. This tells us that Luthen is kind of talking a big game to cash in. But everything's kind of built on hope. I mean, this is an important mission. They are not doing well. He describes it as, you know, I can only forage for so long. The ISB is on the hunt, and the Senator is going to have to take this two-faced carving for her husband's Day of Days gift. Two-faced? The symbolism is real thick. And again, in the hands of lesser writers, it would be disastrously bad. But here?
It's a daring choice. But I trust you'll have the courage to turn back if it should be a bit much.
I appreciate that. You'll be here?
Well, if not, Clea can always reach me. Clea, can we have this wrapped for the Senator?
Oh my gosh, you guys, it's so good. A speeder bike hums into the rebel camp on Aldani. Oh no! It's an Imperial officer. It's Lieutenant Gorn, and he's there for some last-minute prepping for the mission. But now he finds out there is a late addition. So he's the inside man. He's also nonplussed to find this out. What's he going to do, though? I love the line casually tucked in about how he was going to be expected to roll with it if an extra body just showed up. We don't know why he's turning against the Empire, but we do know that he is nervous and he knows what will happen. And we guess there's plenty of reasons for him to turn.
Clem! We need another hand, and you know it.
I should have been consulted.
On that we agree. Clem, this is Lieutenant Gorn. He's our contact at the garrison.
Wounded, on top of it.
On top of what?
On top of being someone I've never met who suddenly got my neck in their hands.
I know the feeling.
We do learn that Gorn has to get back for a midnight inspection, and the flyby that Clem and Vel witnessed earlier, it's in advance of this engineer from Coruscant, and they're mapping old trails. Now, what's going on Aldani? I mean, if it's quiet out of the way, maybe it's going to be a more important hub, and this engineer is being brought in to plan out future expansion of the garrison. They don't have much time, though, so they're going to have to brief Clem, get him up to speed quickly.
Are we done?
Who is he?
He's Clem. He's here. That's all that matters.
Look, we're wasting daylight. Let's get on with it.
Back on Coruscant, we get to see the Chandralin Senator's home. Mon Mothma returns to her residence for another absolutely amazing scene. First, the design of her apartment is over-the-top extravagant, and maybe this is her cover. You know, like Luthen. When she gets home, she takes off some jewelry. Remember when we saw Luthen putting rings on? Well, she takes off her necklace and lays it in front of a flowering bonsai, which, remember, I mentioned Deidre had one of those before. So maybe she's from Chandrila. Maybe, just maybe, Deidre is a mole for Mon Mothma. Maybe, just maybe, her position being tenuous is because of her ties to Mon Mothma. Maybe, just maybe, she's the one that she wants to bring in. I would absolutely love that twist. But hey, I don't know. I love the whole scene, though, because the senator finds out the dining room's being prepared for a dinner. Now, she kind of knew about the Day of Days, right? But I thought it was prepped for that. But Perrin, Mothma's husband, appears to be hosting an old army buddy of his or something. And if Perrin is retired, he might all be about partying, living it up. He definitely does not know about his wife's secret life, right? She has no place of sanctuary. Even at home, she has to be on edge.
Bars, Danga, Slymore from the Vizier's private chamber?
Is that a problem?
You can't be serious. These people hate me. They spend every day trying to undo anything I've touched.
Well, perhaps tomorrow they'll think twice.
Now, Perrin isn't completely wrong here. The problem is, he doesn't know she doesn't want to play the Empire's ballgame. He also doesn't know that the compromise part of her job as a senator only works one way. You know, the rich get richer in the Senate, and who cares about the people? Like Partagas said earlier, you want order? Just send in the troopers. Now, a lesser showrunner would have let the costume department dress this guy in a bright pink outfit with eyeshadow, maybe even a dress or S&M gear or something. They just would have excused it as, oh, that's Chandrilan customs that we don't know about. So this subtle touch of having him dress, you know, basically like a wealthy samurai, it's just the right touch. We get it. He and his wife fight. Now, you know, if Taika Waititi had done this scene, I won't say it. I liked Thor Ragnarok, by the way. I'm just saying, there's a place for over the top, and this is over the top without being a problem.
Don't seat them near me.
Oh, I've taken care of that. You're at the boring end of the table. These people are fun.
Oh, are they? Are they fun? Well, we should find some Gorman guests for tonight and see how amused they are. Your fun friends just cut off their shipping lanes yesterday. Do you know how many will starve? Perhaps we can laugh about it over the third course.
Perhaps you should have a rest.
If you make me pay attention, I will, and you won't be happy.
Gorman, that's a direct reference to the thing that will get her a wanted poster and will end up in her being branded a traitor to the Empire and on the run. Gorman's shipping lanes do lead to starving, then a protest where people are massacred. She speaks out about it, I think in Rebels, then she goes into hiding.
Don't do this again.
There's rumor you bought me a present.
It's going back.
Must everything be boring and sad?
Oh, Perrin, you twit. So the mission briefing on Aldani is brought to you by Dungeons & Dragons miniature creating Nemec. Seriously, his model is fantastic. Akhti Amaug, the Valley of Caves? I wonder if that's a tip to one of the plot points that we're going to see play out. Vel says the Empire came through 13 years ago. So this is 5 years from the Battle of Yavin, which means that thing must have happened right when the Republic fell. Maybe this was a separatist planet then. The Sacred Caves, Sacred River, have no meaning now except to the natives. There was a base 50 or 52 clicks west of the valley called Alkenzi. And so a click is a kilometer, by the way, and that's both in the real world and in the show. Sounds a lot better than a kim for km kilometers. I guess also it's because of the repeated harsh K sound that when you're talking over comms, you can hear click better than you can hear 50 kilometers.
We're taking crates of payroll from that room, loading the freighter, and escaping out of the runway tunnel.
Obviously it's not to scale.
Escaping? In a Rona?
Yeah.
Those were TIE fighters we saw on the way in. How far is the airbase?
From the garrison.
50 clicks, you said.
52.
Fine, 52. They'll be on you in minutes.
9 minutes. We've timed it.
Okay.
The stakes are high. It's game over if they get caught. It's game over if they're not quick. It's game over because they're basically flying a transport away. But hey, if you listen to the writers of Obi-Wan Kenobi, that shouldn't matter, right? Remember the slow-moving transport that supposedly Moses Ingram's character could not catch up to, even though it was right there? Well, I mean, of course it matters. And we all appreciate writers with brains who set real-world stakes for us, even in a fantasy setting, because now we feel the danger in this rather than questioning the logic like we did on Obi-Wan. So what's the solution?
The Eye of Aldani. Thousands of them. They'd hike for weeks to get here just to see it from the sacred land.
To see what?
Imagine 50 meteor showers all at once, but like a curtain being pulled across the sky. Until the eye, the window to the galaxy forms over the horizon.
You've seen this?
I've been here almost 7 years. I've seen it twice. It's not the event it used to be. Now they've got everyone relocated, it's a pretty sad affair, but the eye, it's not something you'll soon forget.
The Eye of Aldani, huh? Sounds like something Indiana Jones would look for.
That belongs in a museum!
So do you!
And by the way, there supposedly was Indiana Jones' whip in carbonite back in Luthen Rail's shop. And I saw that online and I thought I would just drop that in here. Because that would be pretty cool, huh? Nemec corrects Gorn, which I can already tell is part of his character. It's charming, right? And also, he is such a goner, isn't he?
Now, you've got a lot to learn and very little time to do it. So, what we need to know is, are you in all the way?
Let's get to it.
Then we get a scene set up early in the episode. Stakes raised in the middle. Now we get Miro learning her place in the pecking order. Partagaz comes back into that meeting room where Blevin and Miro are waiting. Blevin goes first. He points out this is a career move more than a real investigation. Partagaz then lets Miro speak, and it's like a game of battleship here. She comes really close to a hit, but a miss is a miss. She thinks this could be part of a rebel scheme, and we know she's right from a certain point of view because it's the thing that brought Cassian and Luthen together. Partagaz, though, points out this could just be a theft for money, right? It's almost like it's kind of a hold your fire, there are no life forms on board moment for the Empire, right? I mean, if R2 and C-3PO get shot out of the sky in New Hope, it's all over. So if Partagaz allows Miro to get her way, maybe the spark of the rebellion gets snuffed out right away. He's not angry. He's just a little annoyed. You know, here's this junior officer from enforcement, in his mind, overreaching. We, the audience, have the benefit of omnipotence here. We know she's onto something, but she doesn't know it, even. And if we're in Partagaz and Blevin's spot, we see this woman is just trying to make a name for herself.
I'm seeing signs of coordinated activity over a number of sectors.
What activity?
Similar items of interest, repeated methods, gut instinct.
You came to us from enforcement.
Yes, sir.
Here, we act on vetted and verified information. Alert me when this materializes into something more definite. Until then, confine future activities to your sectors. Thank you, Lieutenant.
Still, she's so close. Partagaz stays in the room when Blevin leaves and actually gives her a pep talk. We don't know why she's this special hire. I imagine we're going to find out why. I just don't think it's because she's a woman. There are women in power all over Star Wars, even in the Empire, like Sienna Ree and Rey Sloan. I think it's more likely where she comes from, or her lineage, or a previous career path, you know, something that might have put her in proximity to a Jedi or a sympathizer, something like that. She could be from a separatist homeworld, like Sev-Tok, perhaps, which is name-checked by Partagaz before he leaves.
You're supposed to be more competent and tucked away. That's why you're here. That's why we're bringing in officers like you. Let's remind everyone of that and not get lost in the dust.
Yes, sir.
On a positive note, I was impressed with your detention numbers from Sev-Tok, far above the quota. I may be sending more of that sort of work your way.
Thank you, sir.
We're done.
Back on Aldani, Cassian gets homework. He's got Rono, freighter specs, a map of the garrison, and Aldani phrases to learn by morning. Homework on the first day of rebellion school, yeesh.
Can I eat my food?
You'll eat, you'll let Cinta check the bandage, and you'll have learned all that by morning. I'll take the first watch.
So what do you think? I was a little worried there would be a dialogue drop-off going from Tony to Dan Gilroy, but there was none of that. Some great lines. Again, delivered well. This show is taking itself seriously, and by that I mean this feels as much like a real-world situation in the Star Wars universe that it can be. I can't wait to see if Miro or maybe Karn gets this Agent Callus treatment. You know, maybe they end up turning good. Or maybe Cashin's going to be the only one who constantly makes it through all of these steps. You know, maybe this is just another mission of the week kind of a thing. And maybe he is the only one that survives time after time after time. Maybe he's just a survivor. And maybe that's all this show is. Now, I want to apologize for not getting to this episode quicker, but Hurricane Ian made house preparation more important. This is the way podcast headquarters did not get hit directly, but that's because people in southwestern Florida suffered that eastward turn. Now, if you'd like to help, the state of Florida has an official disaster relief fund that you can feel safe donating to at www.volunteerflorida.org/donate-FDF/. For this show, you can send feedback or comments, and we will continue with episode 5 next week. In the meantime, please subscribe to this podcast. Send in your own thoughts and ideas via email to thisisthewaypodcast@gmail.com. Leave us a positive review on whatever podcast distribution center you use. Find us on Twitter and Instagram @thisisthewaypod, on facebook.com/thisisthewaypod. And our Linktree site has all our links. linktr.ee/thisisthewaypod. All one word. Thank you for joining me today for the 4th episode of the 1st season of Andor. I'm your host, Steve Lascalzo, and this is the way. May the Force be with you always.